Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I am Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diane.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you, Rob?
Today, Russell, I am feeling like the cameras are rolling and they're also flashing everywhere I go. And it seems to me it's just become quite a busy weekend. Literally, it was my mum's birthday. And everywhere we went, we were, taking pictures. I went to visit Tracy Emin, the artist, and she's got new kittens. And all I was doing was taking pictures. And it got me thinking about this phenomenon of the era we are living in, where everyone is a photographer. And even I am a photographer to the point where, I'm taking pictures all the time. But for me, they're just, mementos of my life. And they kind of often have very personal, fleeting moments. Like, I might see a cloud in the sky here in Margate that I will want to take a picture of for some random reason, and I don't even share it with anyone. But there's this kind of phenomenon now where I feel like when we were kids, maybe we had kind of disposable cameras with the film, and I used to actually really enjoy even when the digital photography era happened and you'd get a digital camera. But the era I loved was kind of when you would have negatives, and you'd actually scroll through the negatives, and you never quite knew what the pictures were going to be like when you went to Boots, the pharmacy here, and got your pictures. You didn't actually see them, whereas now it's all so immediate. So it got me thinking we should be talking to an artist who we adore. Our guest today is someone that I first met very briefly in 2011 because I was kind of emailing him a lot at the time. I wanted to make an audition with him and even, I think, maybe show him at Carl Friedman Gallery. I can't remember, but I met him at the Deutsche Börse Prize, which he was one of the nominees of in London in association with the Wonderful Photographers Gallery. And at the time, it felt like there was this new generation of photographer. Mm. There were other people that I was close to, like Torbjörn Rodland, who is also in LA. And there was a whole kind of crew of new photographers from all over the world who were looking at photography in a very new way. And the question I have for today's guest, which is an important one, is what is an image and what is photography now? And it's a kind of really interesting thing to think about in relation to his practice and his work, because it's so extraordinary, this body of work so far in his life. And I know that you are a collector of his, I believe, because I think I've seen some at your house.
I have a work, yes.
Yeah, exactly. They're quite alluring objects, his work as well. They've always had this real draw to them because of the way they're framed and they're presented, and they're kind of almost sculptural. You almost want to reach in. They're very seductive objects as well as being photographs. And as his work's gone on, there's also been amazing films and all kinds of work, which we will be discussing very soon.
Well, yes. Well, he's been described as saying, though, you're saying that they're photography and sculptural, as he is introducing a picture but asking for it to open up like an object.
Yes.
So. Yes,
indeed.
We'd like to explore that further.
We would like to welcome to Talk Art,
Elad
Lazri.
Hey.
Hi.
Wow, this is such a pleasure to hear you guys speak. Just saying, hearing nice things is always fun for an artist. I think we all kind of spend so many years of hearing about things that don't work, or which is completely okay too, but it's nice, especially. You guys speak very well. It's nice to hear.
Yeah, like the struggle of being an artist, the kind of realities of behind the scenes. I think sometimes the life of an artist is actually very solitary as well. It's quite a lone pursuit in many ways. Mm-hmm. It can be, definitely be a struggle.
Where are you in the world, Elad?
I happen to be in New York.
Oh, you're in New York? Because you're normally based in Los Angeles. You're Israeli-born, Tel Aviv-born, based in Los Angeles, but now you're in New York.
Yeah, I have been in LA for... a random semester in San Francisco in undergrad, and a year in Greenpoint when it was just kind of becoming Greenpoint, so essentially Brooklyn, but otherwise New York, LA. So I happened to be in New York for a period of time. So
what was the draw being like from Tel Aviv as an artist of Los Angeles for you to then really create your practice?
That's a good question, and I've been asked that and developed in my thinking about it. Maybe kind of had to ask myself that, but I think that the real kind of the first part of the answer is a bit of a coincidence, as much as such thing can be a coincidence applying to a school, but yet it is, because I kind of did so by very analog research of, you know, it was a bit, you know, I'm 43, so at the time internet was just starting to become common in household, like connections. So I was still kind of, oh, I'm going to go to the embassy or whatever. So yeah, I kind of researched art schools. Mm-hmm. It happened when I realized I want to go to art school and didn't know much about art school. I was very much rejected from Slade. So I kind of thought to go to England first.
Really? So you tried, you were considering London before?
Yeah, I kind of thought that's closer. And I was kind of a fan of English culture.
Yeah, of course.
In Israel, we kind of like geek over English people, you know.
Do you?
Like
Anglophiles. All right.
I think, yeah, I mean, if you're like in the city, I mean, again, this is 90s. I mean, now everything is different in the world, right? I mean, no one cares about being sophisticated. But but back then it was kind of, you know, records. You go to London to get records. You go to London to get rare magazines, or, you know, you come back with culture, you know. So, so yeah, so that was my first thing. I applied to Slade and it was like, no. It wasn't like, no. I mean, so I was like, okay, well, okay. So then I thought like, well, let's look at American schools too. And I came across CalArts, and being kind of at the same time as I was coming across artists that were influential for me and all had affiliation to that school. And I didn't really know much about it. As a matter of fact, when I having lived in the city, as in Tel Aviv, which kind of aspires to always be like very urban, there was a bit of a, I guess, compensation of like, we're not completely Western or whatever that is. That's like, I feel like sometimes we overdo it. It's like, we're going to do more drugs. But, you know, so I think being from the city, I kind of assumed that art school would be, so I didn't really understand that CalArts is very much in the suburbs. I read great things about it in terms of like their approach to art. I was in a place in time of like transition and kind of, I guess the kind of energy you have in your 20s. So I thought it all kind of seemed like, you know, they were very welcoming and just seemed great. When I got there, I was actually picked up by two students who it was their work study to pick up international students, I guess. So it was like there's two character animation students like waiting for me. And I think I was like arriving in like a Van Nuys airport or something random. And they put me like in this like Nissan, which was also my first car actually. But and we started driving, and it was kind of like, you know, like it was like very cinematic, like you're the guy that's arriving from the desert. And I was like, and it was just, I started driving and I was like, wow, this is not coming together. It's not starting to look like a city or anything that I know. And I realized that the school is actually, when people say Los Angeles, it's like Los Angeles County. Like, so it's like,
right,
you can be very much like nowhere and you're still in LA somehow. And then I said that I think instead of getting a dorm, I'm going to get an apartment in San Francisco, not knowing that San Francisco is
miles away,
five hours drive.
Yeah.
So anyway, that'd be quite a journey to class.
So that's how I kind of, it was very much of a coincidence in that sense that I didn't know as much about it aside from its excellence in contemporary art education. And then it took some time to get used to how, yeah.
But this is the California Institute of the Arts, and here you studied film. So prior to studying...
No, I studied film and I did two majors. I did studio art and film.
studio art film. So prior to...
I did the Devil.
Right. But prior to being there, did you have... were you making like films yourself, or did you have a camera back in Tel Aviv? How did you know that this was, you wanted to be an artist, like growing up in Tel Aviv? What was the sort of culture there for you to recognize this?
I think by way of how I was thinking, mostly that I always felt that in order to feel a sense of spiritual, for lack of a better word, or like, you know, selfhood, or like being, or because it's not quite intellectual. That's why I'm kind of looking for a word that reflects more of what it is, that in order to feel there is a certain commitment that's sort of built in to thinking in a way that doesn't always line up with what is introduced to you. Mm-hmm. And I think slowly you start wondering what is this sort of impulse and what kind of avenues it takes you to. Meaning, is it something that isolates you? Is it something that enriches you? And then you slowly mature, maybe, or kind of like explore your curiosities the more you understand, wait, maybe it's like what art is. And I guess I'm referring specifically to what art has kind of become. It has become that over many, many decades, but in different pace with some setbacks. But I think essentially American schools, at least, it has been several decades where there is a sort of space where you can really develop that sense of an artist as a thinker, which is kind of the education I feel like I essentially received. Mm. But so it wasn't so much about, I think it was, via maybe not finding ways to completely fulfill that within the structure I kind of had, because art was still rather, I guess, like there was more of like a sense that I sometimes see here too. I think you always see it as an artist, where you sort of like meet people that you quite find interesting and you kind of want to have a conversation, and then they hear that you're an artist And you know, and there could be like Ivy League lawyers or whatever, and they'll say, that is so cool. You know, like, do you do oil? Or, you know, or, and then you say, no, actually, I don't really paint. Or, and they say, that's awesome though. Like, being creative is so important, you know, something like that. So it's like, it's still kind of, recognized. You know, and this is like kind of Americans who have a system for contemporary art. So I think it's interesting because, you know, one could say, I could think like, well, is it because my mom is an engineer? Is it because I grew up in Israel? But like the truth is that, you know, it is really a pursuit. Like I think you meet people that, you know, that spend time thinking about what art is, thinking about poetry or whatnot, and others who don't really have the need for that, or for them it's just something that, and I don't say it in a blaming way, it's just a reality that, you know, for some people it's just something that, you know, they'll just tell their kid, oh, you know, he's an artist, you know, like to make sure like that the kid knows that there's like artists in the world, you know, like.
But to make you, sure you were told that, though. You were made to feel like there were artists. That was an available choice path for you to take.
No, I was not. No.
Right.
I wasn't told anything, though, like meaning that there was no, I didn't grow up with this sense of like concern of what do I know my opportunities are.
Right.
No, not in the sense of negligence, that just the culture was very much of, you know, people have jobs and you notice what they do, and you know there wasn't such a kind of, I think today you see more a facilitation towards like, you know, did you know you could be an astronaut or whatever that is. And where I grew up more where it's like, if you're really great at, you know, physics, you might think about astronomy at some point. Like there wasn't a push, like not to say that there was a lack of culture, but there was, the culture was, I think that's interesting, actually, as Europeans, you guys might have, but then I think England might be an exception a bit, but I do often think with friends that are from countries that have very strong identity, in France, Italy, and I find that they too have a very difficult time to be artists in their country. I find that sometimes the kind of, like Israel, in the case of Israel, it's a little bit less... less fun of a context than like Italy or something, the kind of specificity. that, you know, that it's more of like a war or that kind of histories, where like in Italy, it's this kind of overwhelming excellence and sort of a complex histories in culture and so on. Same
more
with
of a
France.
Pressure then, more of a pressure. You
think. Yeah, like yeah, history,
and responsibility
yeah.
to, you know, what's being
there
and
is more of a difference. You know, they say, maybe that's a bit of a tangent about something, but there is a, it takes me back thinking about when I speak about my history, I think about other friends who are from Europe, who are from countries who have much more art funding or art in their life.
Yeah.
Yet they still had to leave, whether it's to Berlin or, you know, that's like, again, this place that has been sort of like had to start over, right? Something has been erased, or to America that has this kind of amnesia, you know, like LA has this sort of a building just goes down and it's like you just put a new one. Mm. Like nothing has this sort of European architecture.
Mm.
And I think like the US being a new country, or Berlin again, that there is something where you don't have to be a French artist anymore. You don't have to be an Italian artist anymore. You don't have to, you know what I mean? And that's interesting because my friends who are from Europe would tell me like, be concerned about their visa or whatever. And I'll say like, well, I mean, the worst thing, I mean, like going back to Paris is not, and they'll be like, no, you don't understand. Like I can't make art there. So it's like, you know, it's quite interesting, like in the relationship, what kind of household you grew up in, what kind of city you grew up in, to think about what is actually the kind of sense of freedom a contemporary artist is often looking for.
Mm. Yeah.
We feel like the person you needed to be, or the place you needed to access, you had to go somewhere else. You had to.
Absolutely.
That makes sense. Yeah.
And yeah.
I think it's like, it's psychological freedom, isn't it? Versus physical space. Mm. So it's kind of like mental space and physical space. And I think somewhere like LA, even though it is built up, especially with when you're driving around and things like that, like you were describing that cinematic element of it, I think there is something very psychologically sort of liberating about it.
Yeah,
if you look back to when you were a teenager, and you mentioned, like, you know, looking at England and sort of vintage magazines that you might have been looking at, did you actually collect magazines? Was that something? Because I know your work obviously references, for those who haven't seen it yet, but your work often references the format of the magazine.
Yeah, commercial
page,
photography and commercial advertising. Photography. And,
Yeah, exactly.
And plays with that scale of like a magazine page.
You know, it's interesting. I mean, it's very tricky for me because, you know, for me, my work often, and I think most work of art probably, you know, they sort of escape you and you feel like you kind of have so much control over what you're making, and then you sort of have to let go of that control. So when you ask about magazines and so on, yes, absolutely. I did collect magazines, photographs. I still do. One of my strong influences is Hans-Peter Feldman.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm saying by that, mentioning him, for example, is the sort of analog sense where he collects postcards and has this sort of like libraries of images. And I know that Francesca Pia, whom I work with in Zurich, and and absolutely am inspired by her as a person also. But she mentions that she communicates with him with letters, by letters. What I'm saying here, while my work had a sort of limitation in its kind of format, through my work, I kept being very interested in the lack of format in a way that the picture has. So there has been, like, I think what drives me often is the sense that this sort of duality, where the picture is on one hand very much of a fixed thing by what it does to us, or what it can does to us, what it can offer us. And on the other hand, the picture is this sort of super sneaky, tricky, cumbersome, yet organized unit. And it's this sort of thing that always kept me coming back to it, in a sense. However, in order to engage with this duality, I sort of had to return a lot to older systems in a way of finding out how much really technology played to these kind of magical qualities of the picture. So what I mean by that is that when we speak of these sort of qualities that a picture has, we often want to have an exit, i.e. a way to sort of like resolve the question that has to do with technology, because technology absolutely is very, very involved in how things change. Yet there is something about the inception of photography and the kind of early years of photography that kept showing an aspect that was sort of out of control. So there is something that is innately out of control. I mean, of course, by the sense of the multiple, but the nature of having a negative that can make many copies, and then the dissemination of these copies. So, you know, of course, perhaps in the 50s, the idea that you could a very troubled individual and take an embarrassing photograph of someone and print it 100 times and send it to everybody you guys know, mail it to everybody you know, and today you can do it online or whatever people do. Mm-hmm. So right, of course, my point is that the picture had mobility, like the negative that allowed exact copies offered a sort of horror, yet also a kind of great privilege at times, but yet the fact that you could have accurate copies of the original that have that are a registration of something accurately carries this sort of like tension that photography has. Yet it keeps kind of evolving, and of course some changes are radical, like the digitization of a picture. But when you think about them philosophically, they're so much in line with what has already happened, in the sense that really, you know, there is this kind of ongoing conversation of the biology of seeing being very similar to a camera. And yet, you know, what we actually see is never quite like what is there.
So, I think just saying that sentence, it sums up your work, is that what we're actually seeing is never what is there, because you are creating these images that play with what we're used to seeing, because you work in this format, which is a magazine size, and everybody coming to your work will see them, and they're all framed in these beautiful coloured lacquer frames which relate to the images, and anyone who knows your work will recognise it straight away as an Elad Lazri work. It's incredible. But you think you're seeing one thing, and then there's these collisions or obstructions that are intentional at every point. So when you look at the image, it actually makes you re-question it. And there's they're full of a lot of quite banal things in there, but yet they end up through your work having an iconic status. So like you will have pictures, studio still shots of like what you would see as some milk or some chocolate or some eggs or, you know, ribbons, bread.
Falling strawberries
or like wallpaper. And it's quite a banal object, like the domestic you're photographing, but then it has it's put into this kind of commercial aspect and given this iconic status as something that we should all desire. It's quite Andy Warhol Americana, the way that the kind of supermarket was then made to be an art gallery for the world to consume.
The thing that happens, I think, that there is a sort of a back and forth that sort of almost like vectors, like this pulling and pushing, and at least in my mind, that I find that I deal with when I make work. And I think that very much what happens in the photo is that I often felt that I would look at available pictures of, let's say, a strawberry or strawberries, and I would arrive at a photo that has few of the echoes that I've seen together.
Hang on, this is a stock archive you're looking at now, because you could some of your images would look at an archive image of,
yes,
of
yes.
So, commercial so either, commercially shot strawberries.
Either that, it's really from any. So what happens would be stock images, and it would also be amateur images that I would get on eBay. So a lot of people sell sell their archive of years of negatives. So if you look at eBay, like photos of flowers, I mean, there will be like amateur photographers that are getting rid of hundreds of negatives of like sunflowers or whatnot. And
right.
It's incredibly, it's very, I mean, it's like a whole thing that is quite excellent. I mean, a way of sort of like recycling. It would be a lot of classes, like people that have taken classes and have shot a lot of negatives. And I often would get sort of bank of images. And then there is, of course, commercial uses of images. And then I would, in the cases where I would make a work, there would be something that comes up together from all of that. There would be sort of like a new aspect that is not quite articulated in each one of them, but sort of like arrived. And I will aspire to make a work that has a lot of that echo together.
Mm-hmm.
So I think what makes me return to the picture is that it has a kind of duality where it is familiar and unfamiliar at the same time.
Exactly.
And often I would do it with mixing what is actually being photographed and its composition or whatnot, but also a sort of technicality. When I started making my photographs, there were two formal elements that were very, as they say here, awkward. And it is that they were very small. And I made some 8x10 photographs, which are the kind of standard size for some industries. And then 11x14s, which was very close to some 1950s.
Well, the first ones were actors' headshots. These are 10x8.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
And then exactly. The magazine size, yeah.
Yes, yes. So actor headshots and also film stills, publicity film stills as well, were available. So and I would keep them at that size. And at the time, I think photography was interested in taking on kind of painterly jargon or sort of this idea of the sublime and sort of being overwhelmed by the print. If you think of the Dusseldorf school or other great photographers who have done incredible work that deals with that. But I think that I was not completely interested in photography. I was sort of figuring out what it is that I'm interested in making. And I was quite interested in sculpture. And I had a period when I would like have some of the pictures I had in my studio. I would sort of have them on a sculpture and I would have them on a shelf. And, you know, again, this is like 2000. Seven, yeah. I didn't really. I was a bit confused of where my relationship to pictures is as an artist. In some ways, I was very much uninterested, and in other ways, I was fascinated. And it was quite confusing.
But that sums up your work as well, because there is sort of like objects are uninteresting in some ways. What is actually being photographed, but by what you've made with them, you've made them fascinating. You've made us want to notice them and recognize them and see what they are. And that is, I mean, that's amazing. That's why I've been drawn to your work. But when we just go back to the scale a bit, why did you settle on that scale? Is it because it's the magazine format and it feels like...
No, it is not.
5 by 14.5 inches.
Okay.
Yeah, it is not because of that. You know, I mean, I completely understand why it comes up, and I'm sure there is... Obviously, it's relevant, but what it really was is that I was working against the picture. I was really interested in working against what makes it a picture in some ways. And I had to have a sort of, you know, the scale was an enormous aspect of what kind of made this kind of gasp. And like when you enter a gallery that you see this, you know, it first exposes the technicality and the mastery, the scale, right? I mean, like when you see a Gursky, when you see, you know, Thomas's Truth, I mean, it's just like, wow, how many negatives are these? Like, you know, and I was using the same negatives, but I was essentially almost printing their contact. So I would photograph something on 8x10 and it would end up being 8x10.
Right.
It had a very uncanny quality. And I would also use a focus that was completely absurd for what I was photographing. And then I was often choosing colors that I found kind of really uncomfortable and there was a lot of that was working against what would happen if I would eliminate all these tools that I have working for me, as in making a photograph.
So the artist isn't present. It's like you're removed.
In some, yeah, I think I removed, what I removed was the applied art aspect of it. Yeah. I mean, meaning that I was not completely removing it, but I was definitely trying to let go of what was not at question.
To let go of something that was not a question. So
not in question. What I mean by that is that the idea of overwhelming a viewer was not interesting to me.
Right. Mm.
So I had to kind of, the idea of connecting with my curiosity about the status of the picture was very much exciting to me. So I think in a way, there was a back and forth where using this negative that is really kind of reserved for the campaign of the car, you know, the time the negatives were also transparencies when you wanted to reach such accuracy. So there is very little leeway in terms of exposure. You know, for example, one of the graduate school I applied to with that work, they asked me after, they said, you know, we do want to know the final size of the works though, because I wrote 11 by 14 on the slides. Mm. So they didn't even imagine that these slides were supposed to, that they thought it was a mistake that it was 11 by 14.
Right.
Today, it's very different because I think that over the, you know, now I see it as a kind of like another thing that like I would like a framing straight to the photo was not very common. It was kind of considered very cheap move, like what you do in a headshot.
Well, yeah, there was loads of like Diasec bonded kind of where you just have like a sheet of perspex cut right to the edge of the print of the photograph. And that was kind of a standard thing where it became very contemporary, didn't it? And very
exactly.
Like,
it kind of elevated.
It was like an elitist thing, like elevating the photograph.
It elevated the photograph, which I later started playing with that notion as well, like kind of going back and forth. But these group of works where there was something very harsh at the same time at how they were framed. And very confusing because there was a very delicate treatment to how they were executed, yet a kind of almost irresponsible like way of like framing, and then there was the subject matter that at times seemed so banal, and was kind of like, is this like a cookbook or like a calendar?
Exactly. And yes.
Yeah, and it was a little bit also confusing genres.
Was that upsetting for you when people were saying this, though, or was that kind of inspiring you more because you're like, this is the challenge, this is the sort of confusion that I'm embracing?
No, it's not. I think people have had a lot of misunderstanding about my efforts. I never cared to be a photographer, let alone a good photographer or anything like that. I have no, and actually when in your introduction, when you said that you took photos and anyone can be a photographer, I love that. I think everyone, I actually find it entertaining because of course anyone is a photographer. I mean, you know, I've had over the years people tell me, oh, you're the photographer. And really, what is it to be a photographer is completely absurd. I mean, there's nothing about it. I mean, being a photographer is simply taking pictures, right? I mean, you know, like being a poet is simply writing words. It's the same thing. Not to say that every photograph is a poem or every word is such, but the idea is that there is a kind of, there was this effort mostly coming from MoMA, that this kind of modernist effort to include photography within the fields of fine art. And some people never went for it. Like Massimo De Carlo told me when he started working with me, just so you know, I never work with photographers. You're the first one. You're an exception. And I was like, okay, thank you. But I mean, you know, I think like, so, you know, when you think about, you know, the famous kind of effort in MoMA to kind of establish this really encompassing photography department and really have scholars around photography and so on and really make it, have it that kind of space. And that conversation is very, very different than what interests me in the practice. It's a great conversation and an interesting conversation to me academically and sort of historically, but as an art practice is very different than what draws me. So I think that, and I spoke to Chris Williams about it, because I think with him, it's really kind of incredible because, you know, he'll just have like a credit of a studio. He was actually with me at the Deutsche Börse, I think. Or was he the
This year is
after?
Christopher Williams, who's another
who's
a photographer who's kind of in the lineage and the legacy of the work that you put out there. Yeah.
And he's like a generation. I think Christopher belongs to a generation who I really find so inspiring.
Mm.
And the interesting thing is that there is a very analytical aspect, even in the way the work is titled and credited and so on. There, it's very much about about you arriving somewhere. There is a accountability, a responsibility, I guess. Mm-hmm. It is a generation where I think, you know, Sharon Lockhart, Christopher Williams, I think in the UK it's the Simon Sterling, I believe, has a very kind of research-based, and the approach is, because it is photo-based, and it has a sort of an aspect to it that it really ties it to the history and photography in a more invested way, perhaps.
Right.
In the sense that I always felt very open-ended, like my research wasn't so much about photography. And within that, there was this sort of idea of existing and the kind of, I think later I started addressing more specifically the sense of like seeing and you know, the sort of like, there's sort of a notion of mediation. But the body of work that we were speaking about was kind of like a foundation that I, that really kind of had me sort of use as developing a language.
Yes, totally. You have developed this language. And you-
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
You've described these works as free radicals, is how I've heard you refer to them before, which is fantastic. So the images that we come to and we've seen, I described some earlier on, like the domestic ones, but then there's like a series of cats, which I love. There's the Bengal cat and the Cornish Rex appears. Mm. There's giraffes, there's zebras. There's all different animals that are in there. Some are very cute. You play with double exposure. It feels like it's a never-ending decision-making, but also there must be rules that you set for yourself. Are there certain things where you're like, I'm not going to photograph that. That's something I won't touch. Or this is something that's something I will never photograph again. Or I need to photograph that one day. And also, are these ever autobiographical for you? Because as we were saying earlier on, the artist isn't present. You want to remove the hand of the artist there. But do these have some coded autobiographical element to them at any point?
Yeah. You know, it's funny because one of my earliest acquisition, the collector came to my studio and he said, oh, I love these, I love that. And he said, and then what they're about, I mean, this is just so wow. And I said, oh, thanks. And he said, well, it's just such a story. And I was kind of getting very confused. And then I realized that he's referring to some biography. Mm. And I was like, oh, yeah, I'm not sure what. And he said, well, your art dealer was telling me that this is all about your biography. And I said, oh, no, I know that I don't think so. So that was kind of, you know.
You were like, no.
It's like, yeah. So it was like, I've spoken to it with a few friends over the years in relation to themselves as well. And just generally, my work does not have biography in it, in the sense of what biography that tries to make a change or sort of like express difference or so on. However, I think being an artist, you always bring a sense of biography, probably, right? I can say that I'm not present. I'm not present in the sense that I'm not working from an emotional place. I'm not curious about my biography at all. When I'm curious about the biography, I like to read the biography. I never found that art is a useful way for me to know someone's story. That's personally my experience. And also my story never made me to want to make art, whatever that is. I mean, you know, people have different stories, but personally, no events of my life were ones of want to make art. I find that good experiences make me want to dance, bad experiences make me have less brain cells. That's about it. Like, I don't, you know, like there's never been, and that makes me want to make art. But maybe, you know, I mean, it is kind of perhaps painters sometimes, I don't know. I think what makes me want to make art is the magic of trying to make sense of things, the thrill of understanding, of confusion. I'm very attracted to intellectual chaos, or, you know, to kind of when an artwork makes you kind of having like an art experience, in the sense of like, this really is touching that thing that is always like circling around, that it just, like, that person who made that had a way to connect with me through ways of seeing and through kind of the desire to make sense, and the affinity to certain topics of being, whether it's the magic of animal. And when I say magic, I mean it very differently than anything sort of romantic. I mean it more as in a sense of something that is yet to be completely understood, you know. So I resort to that word because I'm not quite sure how an animal thinks. I'm not quite sure how a plant is a plant. So I mean, the thing that we are sort of like coming to, for a lack of a better choice, we come to accept a world, and you know, we don't really have the, we don't always have the luxury to dwell on what a philosopher might do, or an artist, or a poet. But when we encounter it and it kind of overlaps with ways of thinking, to me, that's art experience, really. That's kind of when you like connect it to the sense of being contemporary or being in the world.
Yeah, so I think there's something also about the mystery then within like the work that you're making, because I think when I first discovered your work, you would almost see it, and there was something quite, it's not chocolate boxy because that's the wrong word, but the colours were so kind of vivid and very attractive. And I remember being in exhibitions of yours where you would like see the collectors and see the viewers, and everyone would get really excited about it. And there's something about that familiarity with the scale, because we talked about it being like 11.5 by 14.5 inches. And then, of course, they're framed, which is so domestic in a way, because you're used to it in a home. Like, we all have family photos and frames and stuff. But what I've always loved about it is the mystery and the kind of weirdness of it. Because to me, it's not about any of that. It's not really, even though the frames are are so perfect and so like sprayed to perfection. You know, they're like these luscious kind of objects that you almost want to like lick or something. They're just like you want to eat them. But the actual content of it, they're so kind of... It's almost like, for me, it's kind of like thoughts. You know, you are inherently a conceptual artist, and they're kind of like working out a thought within each photo. And it's like you see all this kind of rigor and all this kind of tension and thought that's gone into what seems like a very simple image, but they're really complex. And I'm really fascinated by that mystery and that kind of...
It's cryptic,
yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah, I think... thank you. I mean, I like... the way you put it, but I think the subject matter and the strategies around it perhaps allowed the evacuation in a sense, like, you know, like you have to sort of drain the photograph to be able to speak of the system. So I feel like there was to me, it was always on the cusp of emptying it out. Mm-hmm. And I think perhaps that's the kind of, you know, I was speaking of photo conceptualism from my teachers and so on, when there was, the arrival was more based on an analysis, where I found myself, perhaps because I was kind of coming of age at the time where there was a transition to a much more abstract space, i.e. digitation, and sort of like literally the photograph becoming a file.
Yes.
It was almost like the philosophy becoming like literal, becoming mm-hmm. like, oh, you know how the photo has that quality that's out of control? Now it is sort of out of control. It can crash. It can get pixelated. It's sort of it's stored on, you know, a cloud or whatnot. So I think there was something that started shifting, not so much in the sense of technology, but it was changing technologically. But for me, that was not a surprise. And as I'm sure for many, clearly that's a medium that's married to technology.
Yes.
And it's going to keep changing.
Yeah.
But what was wonderful that it was sort of articulating a conundrum that's so kind of exciting.
Mm.
It was kind of saying this very fixed thing that shows you details, the capacity of the negative, of the large negative, is now a file. And it's sort of like, you know, it can be hacked. It can be manipulated in a much more... in a way that is much closer to the way we understand manipulation, where before manipulation was this kind of thing that, oh, this one person can really retouch a negative,
mm-hmm.
right, for the magazine, or someone is very good at burning and manipulating like a black and white negative or whatever that is. So yeah, there's something about that brought me to a place where what I was interested in had very little to do with what is in the picture. In other words, what is in the picture is that its importance is very different than what traditionally we thought of the photograph is.
And then at some point there was sculptural elements came in. So we talked about the framing and the lack of framing, and you use like walnut framing a lot, which I love, and sometimes there's metal framing, but then sculptural elements started to appear. These to me felt like Ellsworth Kelly offcuts that were then kind of hanging from the frame at points, and then you would have like medical tubing come out, and like Eames ball bearings would be in there, and then there would be things that the frame would actually be a sculptural object in itself, like without the imagery, so it felt like a Donald Judd element in there. So there's all these kind of, at one point, carpet. I love that, like these motel shag pile carpets would obscure half the image at times, and silk, you made silk pockets for them to sit in. All of these things you're constantly exploring of how to see an image as an object, right? So these sculptural elements, this is when did these all start getting introduced, and how is that moving for you going forwards?
So the interesting thing is that I was feeling like it was my first exhibition was that essentially, right? And I think that's, again, that is something that I also find myself talking to over the years, not so much anymore, but over the years, you know, we used to talk about art more, like people that you hang out with. And I feel like we all talk about this aspect of how different what you might have intended for to how it's conceived and so on, perceived. And I feel like in that case, when I made the early work, I felt like it's funny because I remember my final critique in grad school. And I remember that people were getting a bit frustrated, as they always do in everybody's critique about certain thing. But in that case, that I kept talking about these two photographs that I was suggesting are the same. And I was just kind of being a dick, but essentially, or not being, but more like, I was more doing that for the sake of the conversation, right? Because like, I was very much talking about what we are saying, that if I'm working in the tradition of eliminating the sort of capacity of the photograph, then what is left really? And then how do we compare between these photographs? So that kind of, the reason I'm thinking about that is the relationship to, I'm thinking about how early in my career, I was interested in the sculptural element. And I think that as my work developed, I found myself expanding or sort of like proposing more ways in which the photograph gets sort of incorporated or taken over or canceled in some ways or sort of eliminated. And then how the difference between the registration of an image. So meaning that I started looking into how much of an image is something that we produce as viewers and how much of it is sort of arrives at an image. So the idea of cropping, you know, so if you look at it, you know, when I collect pictures, some arrive with very physical cropping, like there actually is an object on it that is cropping it, like whether it be a tape or a kind of vinyl. Of course, that's much older. And of course, that was also done a lot for negatives. And I think I found myself incorporating a lot of objects with a photograph and sort of proposing this idea that if the viewer would have a sort of democracy in a sense of making the image. And maybe it's connected to this kind of neurological aspect of what we see and how we see what is being mediated. And then I remember making a few performances where I dealt with the notion of watching something live and having it have sort of the stage having a focal points like and apertures and so on, and in a way asking that to become a film without the camera. So I think like there started being a back and forth between with sort of proposing a philosophical question more than anything else of when is something mediated, when do we see something as an image before as something present. So this question of representation and presentation became something that I like the idea of plasticity, that is also with time we hear more about plasticity of the brain, that is sort of a much newer notion, yet and plasticity of eyesight, and even when we think about like early motion pictures and so on, this idea of how a picture has motion, right? This sort of like this sort of in a sense, help from the eyesight, right? We sort of like produce that mobility or a stop motion animation, right? I often find myself attracted to that space that is not executed in a scientific manner, meaning that like my work is never, I'm never interested in breaking down anything or analyzing anything or saying, have you noticed? Like, to me, that's not the art experience. To me, the art experience is this very subtle sense of movement or shifting.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
There's a quote you've got here. He says that you're fascinated by the collapse of histories and the confusion that results when there is something just slightly wrong in a photograph.
Yeah.
So it's like it's making you reanalyze what you're seeing. And that's your plan.
I love the fact that I'm losing English as I age as opposed to gaining.
We all are.
I'm like, I cannot. I'm like, I used to be able to speak. It's very much that. Yet, I think it is driven by things that are more, that somehow holds a quality that can be explored further. And as an artist, you know that, yet you're not as interested in being the one that does that, because I think the making of the work has that a potency. I mean, the making of a work that one is engaged with typically has a kind of tension and history of curiosity and passion that in a way also is asking you to let go of that.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
And you let go because you know there is a lot there. I mean, I speak at least for myself, like, you know, not in any, I mean, you sense, like, otherwise that's why we make art. I mean, you kind of have a desire to connect via an artwork.
Yes.
And that desire, I would think, is a belief that there is a potential of connection there.
Yeah. Well, you're definitely interested in the audience when you make your work. I'm sure you make work for yourself, but it feels like you're very conscious of an audience for your practice.
Yeah, and to be frank, I don't make work for myself really. I wish I could say that. I mean, I think that sounds so much better, like kind of, you know, independent, and it's kind of sexy, you know.
It is sexy.
But yeah, it's not me. It's I'm very much making work from a need to connect, like the sense that someone, meaning that, you know, I think there is a big difference between making work for people to making work from yourself wanting to connect. So I think, like, you know, if I didn't make work for connection, I would already have moved to the desert and so on. But I think that as an artist, you really thrive on that. It's a very strong thing within artists, that the need to have the work resonate with people reminds you of everything that usually matters to an artist, which is kind of being human and having, like, there's something very lonely about finding yourself making art.
Mm.
Very, very excited by that human connection that happens. And it's not a connection in the sense that you necessarily see or, you know, I mean,
feel, but you know, it
is the fact that it moves, that the work moves.
Well, I think that also must be for you from coming from so many exhibitions. I mean, what has the art world been like for you? Because, I mean, 2020, you had a massive solo at San Francisco MoMA, huge. You've had huge exposure over the years. Has it been up and down? Has it been hard to navigate? Or have you felt quite comfortable and confident with the amount of success you've had? And
that's a big, big question. I mean, it's a good question. It is tied to so many other elements. So there is there is an aspect of what does it mean to someone to have the work be of interest, your art be of interest. And then there is an aspect of what does it mean in terms of navigating working relationships, how you see the world and how people that you would find to mentor you see the world and things. So there's like different aspects. I can say that I was not necessarily expecting to have my work liked. Yet when your work is liked, it comes with a sense of, you know, the art world has changed so much, even in the few years that I can think of. But I think that I think the biggest experience for me was accepting that there is very little that you can do about how people experience your work.
Mm-hmm.
And when you start exhibiting, you're so humbled by the fact that people are interested You know, if I think of grad school, we all, you know, really liked making work, but none of us really had a sense that necessarily other people would like it.
You could never know, would you? You just never know, right?
Exactly. So I think part of you is very kind of humble. It's like, you know, we learn to always say yes to offers because you never know when someone wouldn't ask you or whatnot. Maybe it's a little bit like acting at the beginning for people. I don't know. But I know, creative,
you're never going to know right. until someone says, oh, you're good. I'll give you money for that.
Right.
Or I'll employ you right. or I'll give you this opportunity. Yeah.
Exactly. So, you know, I mean, I never knew that. I always thought that I liked my practice, but you don't necessarily know if it's going to connect with people, just the same way that sometimes you don't connect with people mm-hmm. as a person, right? That is something that can be a new aspect of what it means to be exhibiting art, right? And, you know, people often talk about, you know, we had a class in grad school called Unwritten Histories, and it was artists who either dropped out or stopped making work for some reason. If we think of Lee Lozano making it like an artwork to stop making work, of course.
Katie Noland,
I was going to say, that's everything, having a show right now, actually, in New York, I think. And then, of course, Jack Goldstein sort of being back and forth and then back and forth in the art world and then returning to the art world and unfortunately taking his own life. And several others, I think that the sort of Lee Lozano would be the best example when people speak of like the art world is someone who made like a manifesto, right, about kind of this.
But you're not going to do a Lee Lozano. It's not like you're now going to disappear.
I'm not comparing it at all. Navigating the art world has been kind of discussed by contemporary artists to the point of like me that having had a class called Unwritten Histories by people that sort of like left or whatever circumstance that have come in and out of making art. What is the art world been for me? I mean, it's changed incredibly. I feel like it's a very confusing time in terms of, I find that there is a lot that is different than what, contemporary art is tricky like that. I mean, there is a sense of I think as artists, like we are taught a sense of responsibility, like at least in my school it came up a lot, the kind of idea of responsibility and intention. So that is something that in times of now that being a pandemic or that I think naturally there's a big shift, right? Art is the first thing that sort of is not essential, right?
Or it is. We think it is here at Talk Art.
Right.
The most essential. But listen, Elad, I'm going to give you some quick fire questions and you've got to come straight in with a response and then we're going to come with the final questions. What is your favorite camera to use? What's it called?
Dude, this is so tough. Not because there are many, just because the iPhone.
Nikon. Yeah, great.
No, the iPhone.
Oh, the iPhone. Oh, right. So you make images from your iPhone. Great.
Yeah. Like, I even though I often make work with 8x10 or whatnot, it's only because I need to. It's not for fun.
Okay. All right. Next question. Dogs or cats? Because I know you once had a Chihuahua. Yeah. Is she still with us? Tuna?
Tuna, Julia, Kristeva,
So dogs or cats, because your work features a lot of dogs and lots of cats.
Yes, both.
Both. Very nice.
Yes.
Ballet, your favorite ballet. You've been told by a ballet dancer that you have amazing feet. Not that you can dance ballet, but if you wanted to do it, you have amazing feet to do it. What is your favorite ballet? Because ballet dancers appear a lot in performances and photography.
Oh, wow, that's awesome. That I can answer. Absolutely favorite is Forsythe, like pretty much any William Forsythe ballet.
Okay.
So and like the maybe mid 80s, In the Middle, Somewhat Elevated, I think it's called, just, if you look it up, many different companies have danced it. It's remarkable remarkable, yeah.
Amazing. All right. Favorite Hitchcock movie? Because we see a lot of Anthony Perkins from Psycho appearing a lot from the film stills. Is Psycho your favorite Hitchcock, or is there another one?
No. That is, that's about Anthony. So yeah, Anthony is, it's not so much about I'm not a big Psycho fan. I'm absolutely consumed. And his sons know that. It's like now we talk about it often with the late Anthony Perkins. So it's a whole kind of ghost in the work that has to do with with a kind of standing for a man, mm-hmm. That has a very complex story. So Anthony Perkins sneaks into the work a kind of heavy history.
Absolutely. Yeah, his history, yeah. So you are consumed with pictures and images, and you are a collector of images. You're saying you hoard collections from eBay all over the place. Do you have one definitive work in your collection that is the best for you, that is your most special?
Not really, because I don't have a special relation to it. It's hard to explain, but I have a special relation to ideas, to be honest, really. I never had a favorite. I don't even have a favorite artwork. I don't have a favorite color or anything like that, because I don't quite work like that.
You're not going to like our next questions then, but is it behind you at the minute? I can see a photograph at work. Is that Christina Ramberg behind you?
Oh, no, that's
Diane.
No, it's Renee. Oh my God, I feel awful now. I'm so brain dead. This is the Dutch painter.
Renee So? No.
No,
it's
Renee Matic?
No. It's Metro Pictures, one of the.
Oh.
Renee Daniels.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Who is, so there's a work of art behind, your head that you have on your wall. Who is that by?
This is actually Renee Daniels.
Ah, with Metro Pictures.
Yes.
There we go. Right, we're going to move on to our final questions.
Yeah, so if you could do an art heist and take home any artwork, we could help you. But it doesn't have to be an artwork. It could be a building or a ballet, because I know you work with ballet. Or it could be anything, basically, that means a lot to you. What would you take home and why?
Wow. I mean, maybe a painting. I mean, I think paintings actually make me happy. You know, I would love like a really, I'll take like a Gaston if someone.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Someone can hook that up.
Yeah, we'll sort that out.
I actually really like the work that you did where you photographed my namesake, because our personal trainer, Russell, and my personal trainer when I was in London, has a nickname for me, which is Rosie. And it's after Rose Byrne, who is someone that you've worked with and collaborated with. And when I saw that, I was like, this is so legendary. Dan, our trainer, is going to be so happy. I love that picture of her where it's all like, you know, very painterly in the
background. That's right, the painter,
That's the art heist I would do if I got one.
Oh, that's so awesome. That's so awesome. I used to really I really like working with actors who are familiar yet not really engaged in kind of celebrity culture as much. You know, I mean, whatever that means, but I mean I like the echo of familiarity as opposed to the overwhelming sense of a celebrity. And Rose was you know, working and so on, but it's funny because literally a year after it, like, she, you know, I guess became like a celebrity. So it was kind of like suddenly the work had a different quality. But when I showed the work, it was still kind of people, oh, is this the woman from, I feel like I've seen her on TV too. And I love that.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
I love that. And
that was when I fell in love with her in Damages, I think.
Exactly. That's when people love your Damages.
Dan always thinks I look like her brother, so like we're meant to be we're distantly
related. Or her sister.
He calls me Rosie. He literally calls me Rosie.
Did you know George, like her brother?
No, he doesn't know anyone related to her.
I don't even know Rose.
Looks like her. What is the best advice you've ever had when it comes to your art?
The best advice was one of my art dealers told me, you know, if you don't feel like coming, it's okay. Like, if you don't feel like coming to the opening, it's okay. Sometimes it's better. So, like, you know, I feel like, maybe I'm joking. But, I mean, like, the best advice about my career, you know, the best advice is always, like, be, like, a really kind of easygoing, right? So like, I guess be easygoing.
Be easy.
Which I'm not, but I guess, you know.
You're not,
I'm saying like, no, I'm not. But unfortunately, I never mastered that. But
Do you think you're hard work then to work with?
Some would say, you know, yeah. But then some actually tell me that, so it kind of depends. Maybe.
Yeah, are you a diva, Elad? Are you a diva?
No, not like that. I think that I find myself often having a hard time explaining myself when I work or feeling misunderstood. So maybe that, you know, so sometimes that can be
frustrations.
The last question we ask every guest is, you're probably not going to be able to answer, which will be a first, but what is your favorite color?
Oh,
you said earlier you don't have one.
I absolutely not have one. Maybe like a bad color, like really bad mess, like mustard color. I don't know, like something I can really dislike. I don't feel like
your most dislike
a difficult color for Elad, is it?
Yeah, I think that's often what with my work I would choose like the kind of like the most obnoxious color. I mean, obviously all colors are great, right? I mean, color is I think like a mark is great, like right with any color. So yeah, I mean like. But yeah, I can't say that I don't experience color like that. Like as like one is nicer than other. Mm. I think I'm more experiencing it as like a perceptual thing. I get more like a nail polish thing. Like I want to touch it, you know.
Mm.
Like it's more like
that's the lacquer effect, isn't it? The framing and stuff.
Yeah. But it's more like I fall right into like a texture or like a kind of spatial quality. So I think of colors more of like what makes something looks narrower or wider or this kind of way. That's like perception related, maybe.
Love.
Well, but, we love that about you. That is a really interesting.
Thank you so much for being.
This has been so brilliant, Elad.
It's been fascinating.
It's been so brilliant.
We've been looking at your work for
so long. And there was one photograph I saw earlier, which was from 2014, and you're a bit of a prophet, and it's called Man Mask Lamp. And it's a guy with a face mask on. Do you remember that work? And in my head, I'm like, that just feels so prescient for now. But you made it in 2014.
Let me add a layer to it. It is my dentist.
There we go.
And this is
that's autobiographical. So it is autobiographical.
Well, that's casting. That's LA for you. I was
that's
looking
casting.
For a person.
It's observation.
And only in LA would you have a dentist that looks like a TV show actor.
Yes.
He looks like, you should be the dentist. Except you are my dentist.
You should play the dentist. Yeah.
Oh yeah. So you know, that's LA for you. And after he did a root canal, I said, you know, I think you would be great for this photo. And he was like, sure. He still cashed his check of like a standard check
for your root canal.
For photograph. Yeah. No. He cashed his check for sitting for a photograph.
Oh.
Just like, you know, for his time. I
always... So you pay your models to sit for you and stuff.
Yeah, just for the time. I mean, it's very much of so I always offered to pay for someone's time to that it only makes sense. A very busy dentist, but it was kind of cool to see like, oh, you cashed it fast. Okay.
Yes.
Awesome.
Amazing.
Well, thank you so much. And are you on Instagram?
No.
That's quite a surprise.
That's quite cool. So we can't actually give you your
handle.
But you can
but
find
I look
your
at,
work
I look at Instagrams of it's funny because Maurizio Catalan asked me in an interview that they just asked me for this interview for a book of his. And he asked, it was like very early on. He was like, are you going to do Instagram? It was like, we're not sure. Not everybody did it even. And I was like, oh no, I don't, I think it's too much for me. And it never changed. Yeah. So,
well, we will link to your galleries.
Yeah. 303 and YQ.
And also the website so they can see your exhibition history.
Yes.
Yeah. The most incredible people, 303, Massimo, Francesca Pia.
Amazing. Well, for everyone listening, we're going to have all images up on our Instagram at Tallcar, and then check out all them links for Elad. And this has been incredible. Thank you so much, Elad.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's been brilliant.
Thanks for listening.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamond and Russell Tovey.
Follow us on Instagram at Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in today's episode, with music by Jack Northover.
Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever it is that you get your podcasts.
Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.